Alright, Talib. I think as today, we have a very high-profile guest on One Mic Stand. Don't you think so?
I know so, man. I know so. Because he is none other than...
M. Ravi.
The How profound lawyer.
Mr. Ravi.
I'm good. How are you doing?
We are trying to be good. In your presence, we are trying to
It's quite intimidating, you know. Honestly, I don't know, Ashraf. I am quite intimidated to have you in my presence.
Well, I'm honored to be intimidated.
Oh,
are you intimidated by us?
I'm honored to be intimidated because I've never been intimidated, but I think I am intimidated. So it's a nice feeling.
Yeah, I guess you intimidate a lot of people. I guess.
Yes, huh? I know. Yeah. No, I don't get intimidated by people that easily because
You are the intimidator.
No, not at all. Why? How can I intimidate people?
Why are we talking about this, man?
That's why it's a silly topic. Like, y'all are so occupied by fear, you know.
Intimidating topic, eh?
Yeah, that's why. I think y'all are, you know, many people are afraid of their own shadows, I guess. Huh?
Really, eh? We're not afraid of our own, we're afraid of yours.
Oh, okay. That's my shadow.
So, what have you been up to recently, Mr.
Right. Just call me Ravi. What I'm up to, I'm just doing my cases and, you know, getting on with my work. And
I saw on your Facebook, you have a lot of things going on.
Like what?
You tell me.
Yes, you said you saw on Facebook, then tell me.
Maybe dancing.
Some of the things I might not be able to say, maybe it's not out yet. Or
no, I mean, the recent one, I went through 9 days of prayer for 24 death row inmates I'm representing who are facing imminent execution
in a
few months' time. Yeah. So I'm just going through my own internal cleansing process. At the same time, I'm praying for the peace and well-being of them and their family. Plus, of course, hoping against hopes that there will be moratorium on the death penalty.
Mm. We'll get to that.
Yes, sure.
Let's start with this first. Why be a lawyer?
Sorry?
Why be a lawyer?
Why not?
You've always been a dream.
Why not?
Oh man, you are answering a question with a question.
Okay, I'll come to the point. Because
why not? Because I can't be a lawyer. Yeah, it was never.
That's the thing. Yeah.
I never thought of it. So,
how did you start out since the beginning, the interest and things like that? You must have gone through a phase. You can't just be
or something
be a
must
lawyer
have happened
fun.
To you that you want to be a lawyer.
Well, all this I've documented in my book called Kampung Boy, but of course I'm not going to go and summarize the book for you here, but I'm going to tell you that I came from a very poor family, and from young I've already realized there are structural deficiencies in society. It's basically the poor, oppressed and the vulnerable are not properly treated, not only in Singapore but also around the world. Whether it's a rich society or a poor society and so on and so forth. But at the same time, of course, Singapore also have presented me opportunities where I could excel, despite the fact that I was from a very poor family. And my mom was a construction worker. My father was alcoholic and pretty much he never worked properly. And then my mother single-handedly, together, of course, my siblings, who struggled also, you know, like my sister went to work when she was 5 years old.
What?
Yes.
5 years old?
Yes. She just picked up. Cardboxes.
Okay.
Yeah.
The one that the old folks now do for fun.
Yes. Those days. We are talking about 1960s, brother.
Yeah.
So she used to pick up those papers. I mean, like, you know, and papers and all that. There are, you know, what we call. I lived in Jalan Kayu, so near our kampung, there are bungalow houses, mainly the then expats. Because in 60s, right, the British were leaving Singapore.
The colonists.
And then the colonists and their families. And so basically, so that was how much young my sisters and siblings went to work. My mom went to construction site to bring seven of us up. So this was the struggle. Within all that, the Catholic Church gave me kindergarten education because they sponsored the, you know, Catholic Welfare Society from St. Vincent de Paul. So with all that and so on and so forth, and I went to NUS to study later arts degree. So I've already fast forward already. Yeah. So arts degree in the early 90s. And then after that, I was doing arts degree, basically sociology and political science, which deepened my understanding into this disparity in society, more in tune with human rights issues and sociological aspects and stuff like that. Then I realized that arts degree will put me into more trouble because I'm not going to get employed. teaching, government service will all reject me because of the fact that the views that I strong views that I hold even in school, university itself. Then I took up law and then went and studied in overseas and came back and took up loans. My primary school teacher, secondary school teacher lent me money.
Oh, they lent me money.
And then also my this particular lady by the name of Sarojini, she was a lawyer. And she took up she guaranteed my loan. When I came back, I'd finished my law in about 1.5 years. It's a crash course because of my first degree. And then, you know, first week I'm landing in Singapore and I got like debts like nobody's business. Banks are chasing me. And so I had to strike out on my own. And in that context, in the first 6 years, I had already had J.B. Jeyaretnam as my friend since I was 17 years old. I was, you know, J.B. Jeyaretnam inspired. He was one of the inspirational figures in law.
So did he rub off some of his...
Yes. He not only rub off, she left a legacy to me to actually...
How is JBJ as a person, man, since you are closely interacting with him?
JBJ is very cute. Because in his own ways, I mean, cute in the sense that, you know, like, you know, I was 17. I went to his... 17, 18, around there, I went to his office to get the Privy Council judgment when he was thrown into the jail by the courts, and then after that he appealed to the Privy Council, and you know, then they restored him to become a lawyer again and stuff like that, restored his license to practice again. So when I went there, it's like he looks very serious, and then, you know, but I can see that there's a bond between him and me. You know, he just talks less, and then I will just sit in his, you know, and then I'll get a copy signed. I will just ask some questions, he'll answer. Then over the years, after my university education and all that, then when I was in practice, I was like assisting him as much as I can in terms of research, wherever, whatever, whenever he needs me and stuff like that. I used to follow him on, you know, legal cases, developed a lot of interest in constitutional law. But on my own, I was practicing more commercial stuff, IT contracts, intellectual property, a bit of criminal law here and there and stuff like that. In the year 2003... J.B. Jeyaretnam cried to me first time. He's such a dispassionate man with that such stature of
such
holding himself. Such a great man, yeah. You cannot see, I mean, he was a judge himself and such a strong politician who was destroyed by the system. And yet this man was in tears when I saw him in Johor Bahru. He had a house there because he was already bankrupt and Singapore was the nightmare for him, you know. So, then he tried to convince me to take up this case because it was already argued by Subhash Anandan in the Court of Appeal, and he said that this case has already run its course, but there are very significant problems in this case. It's a Malaysian boy from Malaysia. His name is Vignesh Murthy, and there's miscarriage of justice. And he says this is terrible, and he drafted the opinion. I won't go into the details, you know. So, blah, 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 blah. I summoned enough courage, and I filed without much experience. I was a young lawyer. And I was appearing before the Court of Appeal on the eve of the execution. I've already filed a few applications, two applications prior to that. Yong Pung Hao, as you know, Yong Pung Hao, the Chief Justice, was back then. And then I was saying that, you know, I've submitted all the arguments. He listened to my arguments and he said that, well, we are dismissing your application. But before dismissing the application, there was an exchange between him and me, and which I said that I basically said that, look, I need more time. I'm rushing around the clock. Please give me a little bit more time. I've already presented all the arguments. I would like to, you know, present even more and then explore. Basically, I was seeking more time. And also I've given all the arguments as much as possible. And because of the irreversibility of the death penalty, you should give a little bit more time so that, you know, but the laws are so strict to reopen a case. All that has happened now in other cases where I managed to reopen and so on and so forth in recent cases where there's a huge development in law. We are talking about in 2003, that was 17, 18 years ago, my first case.
And you were a young lawyer doing this?
Yeah. And Yong Pung Hao said, are you then saying... So he says that no, the case has run its course. It's too late. Basically, that's what he's trying to say, you know. So I said, no, this man is basically... I'm trying to say that this man is not too late because the man is alive. Tomorrow is dead, and if we wrongly execute him, can we bring his life? Essentially, I'm trying to say that to the court. So I said, time? Are you then saying that an innocent man can be hanged because of procedure? Like procedure says that, you know, the procedure is closed. So procedure, men invented by men, we can always, you know, give that procedure a little bit of flexibility to look into the justice of the situation. So he says no. Then I said, are you saying the innocent man can be hanged for want of procedure because of, you know? He says yes. The answer is yes. To which I said, no one shall be deprived of his life or liberty save in accordance with law. And law must mean an innocent man cannot be hanged. I shot back. And that's what Article 9 of the Constitution of Singapore holds in terms of the presumption of innocence and so on and so forth. And then the boy stood up, Vigneshmurthy. So he says he's dismissing the case. And so he, Vigneshmurthy, stood up because I was so shocked to hear that an innocent man can be hanged for want of
procedure. If I were him, Vignesh, I would feel fucked
terrible, man. Yeah. Just
I feel shitty. I'm lose my life soon. And this guy over there is saying that, you know, he can't be appealed or whatever and I'm going to be hanged.
And then Vigneshmurthy stood up. He spoke in Tamil to the interpreter. He said, now, my lawyer is asking, I think he said 2 weeks or 3 weeks only. Could you not give him the time? And he's essentially, he said, please execute if you must. I mean, he's basically, you know, he was even informing me that basically what Vigneshmurthy is saying is that he does not mind if you take my life in 2 weeks. Just give the 2 weeks to M. Ravi. That's all. And take my life if you must. Is that too much to ask? You know? And then Yong Pang Hao says that, then also Vigneshmurthy pressed on further and said that, I was quite, of course it was emotional, but I was quite impressed by what he was saying. Even as a lawyer, I was like, it was too much already, you see, overwhelming for me already. You know, Jeyaretnam was not in Singapore, he was in London. And then at that time, so I couldn't even turn to him fighting. And anyway, things were moving so fast, you know, like Singapore was so efficient about everything. So anyway, so the thing is that, even very efficiently, you know, so the thing is that, of course, certain signals like that under the table, I'm going to show you, you know. Anyway, let me continue with this intense moment in court.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
So basically, Vigneshmurthy was saying that, okay, 2 weeks, blah, blah, blah. Then he said, okay, if you don't want to give me, minimum I want you is to write the judgment and I want to read before I die. Why are you executing? My lawyer have submitted so many points. I need to know. Have you considered them carefully? Write the judgment and tell me why I need to be and kill me.
Yong Man, this Yong is Pang such a
Hao
moment.
Said, it's all in my book. Yong Pang Hao said, you know, with the, you will, you know, that's the beauty of Spotify with a tulabang mana mana negeri punya orang semua satu satu hari tahu itu macam cerita. Okay, anyway, that's for the certain section of the oppressed elements. Okay, so anyway, the thing is that
wait, what crime did he commit?
No lah, I mean drug trafficking.
Ah, okay.
So anyway, allegedly, he didn't commit the. Of course, that's what they said. But he is innocent as far as I'm concerned because the IO statement was undated, unsigned. IO took statement, right? Undated, unsigned. That particular IO later, 3 years later, we found out through one journalist, he was charged for sodomizing a girl.
Oh, Malaga, man.
With another officer.
And how?
And it was already, this was all going on.
Oh.
So,
how do we start with this?
Anyway, the thing is that finally Vigneshmurthy asked for, right, you know, and then he was executed. Then when he asked for his, you know, Yong Pang Hao replied, your judgment, you will be, what do you call, you know, it will be issued to you in due course. He was executed next day. 2 weeks
next
later.
Day.
Next day. Next morning he was executed. 2 weeks later, I got the judgment. You know.
But was it useful? Like that? I mean, it's useless radio.
Exactly. So, what I'm saying is that next day, this is the defining moment. When I went to the crematorium, Mandai crematorium, it's 8 o'clock, 6 o'clock they execute. Vigneshmurthy has a sister. One is 18 and the other one is 21. they were, you know, these two young girls recovering his body, mothers, you know, completely messed up, and then understandable, and the police were basically saying that, you know, like, they get to get funeral arrangements by certain time. If not, the state will conduct its own funeral. And they were just, you know, getting the body, you know, proceed with the Indian casket company, and which Raju casket was there. So the sisters were calling me after all that nights of sleepless nights that I was taking up this case. Went to Mandai crematorium. I told the police, please, sir, stop. They need to be given dignity and respect. Give the body to the family first. Let them decide how they want to actually conduct the funeral. You must allow poor people the time. These people are poor from Malaysia, you know. You have to allow. So I paid some money to the casket company also. And then I told them, please, sir, dispose this. I mean, like, you know, all these things must be done properly. And then they transferred the body to another casket company. One lorry I hired from Chinese funeral company, you know. And then for embalming services, which exploded to about $10,000.
Oh, man.
And then, of course, the casket company went after me every month because I said, give a good funeral. I brought, okay, before that, the defining moment, why human rights law that I have been championing since 2003. When I went to the crematorium, I saw Vignesh's mother pummeling his chest on the hearse. And recovering, and she thought that the son's eyes are open slightly, she felt. And then she's pummeling his chest to revive him. This going on. And then, so the question I asked, you know, will our country, Singapore, will this metropolis collapse because of our humane response to death penalty? Why should our success be tainted with this blood? And we are the Disneyland of death penalty in 2004. But now it has gone down after years of campaigning and whatnot. So that was the highest in the world, per capita, Vignesh Smriti. Because on the eve of that, that period, Goh Chok Tong was asked how many people were executed. And he said, I think 70-something. Then after that, he changed the figure to 35. He himself was not sure. That's a kind of contempt I believe they have for human lives, I think.
Okay, we have to scale down back here again. I think it gets too intense the first 10-15 minutes. So let's go one step down, okay? Besides being a lawyer, you're a speaker and you're also a politician at one point
time. One point of time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And not a politician, I went and stood for elections.
That makes you a politician.
Politician means it's a period of quite a bit of time, you know, then you become politician.
You campaign.
No. I went once and that's it.
Doing it because it's JVJ's party?
Sorry?
Are you doing it because it's JVJ's party at one point in time?
Precisely the reason why.
Really?
Yes. Oh. One of the reasons why I gave to, you know, it is in memory of Gerard Nam.
But I mean, you gave your all. So
I gave my part. And that's it. I've moved on, you know, yeah. But of course, I respect him. Yeah.
And you are also, I would say, a dancer.
Yes.
Traditional or exotic? No, just joking.
Exotically traditional. Traditionally exotic.
And yeah, basically, I think I've seen your Facebook and the things that you do on Facebook and things like that. So basically, the question is, you are an exceptionally good lawyer. Without a doubt. You've been around the block. But why are you, the exact opposite of what a lawyer does, and, you know, you dance and things like that. You're just like this happy guy.
Yeah.
And the causes that you champion are insane, man.
It's like not some polar opposite.
But there's a method to the madness, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes. You see, first of all, one should not, I feel, box one into you're a lawyer, you're a doctor, you're a this. Expected, I perform my role well in court. My work speaks for itself. But at the same time, I'm also a free spirit. I'm a Hindu, I'm a yogi, and I have my free spirit. And, you know, Singapore is an overly ordered society. So when you dance, you get misunderstood. This, you get misunderstood. That, you get misunderstood.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's like Spotify, all this platform, which I'm also quite pleasantly surprised to see, you know, local guys like you, like where there's a free exchange of ideas is happening. So it's great. So just like the same questions, like, you know, you guys, hey, why vulgarity, man, in this platform? Odd, what, odd, right, the oddity. So I just feel that what I'm doing is not really complete. I mean, traditional dance, classical dance is fantastic. But the manner in which sometimes maybe I'm more, you know, like speaker's corner, I might just perform. It's my own artistic expression. Instead yeah. of instead of like speech, I dance.
After all, you have a arts degree, man.
No, arts degree is a separate thing. But I'm talking about dance.
Mm-hmm.
Dance and art degree is completely different.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
It's actually, again, you also have a point in the sense that why should we actually box up here and there? Humans, yeah.
But the thing is, some people expect these kind of expectations of a lawyer. You must be this, you must be that. An expectation of a prime minister, you must be this, you must be that. You can't do this, you can't do that. But you cross all lines.
You see, the most successful prime minister in the world right now is the Canadian prime minister. He wears underwears to gay parties. You know.
Be that?
No, I mean, gay parade. He wears like, you know, very, you know, pompously
yeah.
and stuff like that. Look at how Canadian community, he goes to Bhangra place, he dance Bhangra.
He got shit for that, huh? With, you know, the brown face.
No,
right?
I mean, brown face, no. There will be good and bad, like, you know, just focus on one topic, like, you know. So, this kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, we'll laugh all this nonsense that he is like, you know. But what I'm saying is that why, you see, a person like him. In this era, Trump, for example, of course, another extreme, but he also has his own supporters and blah, blah, blah. The, you know, different people, leaders come, you know, I don't put them myself in that category, but I am my own free spirit. And I think that being Singapore as a society, I think we should just mature ourselves more in terms of accepting variety of expressions. I think that's what our society needs, actually.
But some people might think that you have two like a split personality. Do you have that?
You see, I okay, let me go back to then that educational element, informational element there, which immediately speaks to that question, which is I am made up of X and Y chromosome. X is what?
X is female, male, I don't know, currently.
I have no idea.
X is female.
Okay.
That's why it's called X factor. If a man, you don't know what's the X factor, then a serious problem. You don't even know your wife, then you'll be in shit, baby. So X factor, X and Y. Y is man. X, this is basic, X and Y.
Yeah.
So these two is in your chromosome. That itself, if you don't even understand that, there is problem. That's when the madness comes.
I know what's plus minus.
Yes, plus minus, fine. So that opposite, of course, attracts. So X and Y chromosome we have, we all have. Women have X and X. So when you have masculine and feminine energy in you, is it diametrically opposed or is it complementing each other? That's something for each individual to understand. So there is nothing in it that is opposite or whatever. It's just that I'm just a colorful personality. That's about it.
So let's say I want to put this question to you. Would you be Jekyll or would you be Hyde?
What's that?
Would you be Jekyll or would you be Hyde? Which would you prefer to be, given a choice?
That's very a difficult question, you know, because it all depends on the weather.
Weather?
Yeah.
Well, let's take a look outside.
Darling. But in the afternoon, you would like to drink something cold, hot weather, right?
That's a good analogy,
like,
yeah.
And night I like something hot.
Hot, baby. Would you like to crush it together? Some nice, lovely ice and drink together.
Okay, fair enough. We've got an answer. Yep.
And here's the question when we go back to the death sentence.
Oh, we are going back there now.
Yeah,
huh?
we are going back there because
okay.
It's such a intense thingy that it sticks in me from that first minute that he spoke about it.
Okay, go.
What do you think of drugs and death sentence? Now, that's a catch-22 situation, whereas, you know, if we don't execute, it becomes a prevailing problem. And if we do, then it's something that Amnesty International or people that's out there will say that it's inhumane.
Now, first of all, let's get the statistics right. Sorry, it may be boring, but this is...
No, it's fine. It's
logical.
Go on.
Logical. Almost two-thirds or more than that of the world's population has abolished death penalty. more than three quarter of the world population has abolished the death penalty for drugs. It is the consensus of the United Nations Security Council, you know, Economic and Social Council in 1984. There was a UN resolution that was passed. This is a UN resolution that we have to accept because we are part of the UN. That death penalty for non-violent crimes is against international law. So it's essentially that's the position that the United Nations, even in 1984, has held. And so therefore, there is no correlation. If you look at, for example, the best country to actually compare is actually, I mean, basically apple to apple will be Singapore and Hong Kong. Singapore and Hong Kong. So Singapore and Hong Kong, I mean, Hong Kong does not have death penalty for drugs. Hong Kong doesn't have death penalty at all. So the homicide rate of Hong Kong has actually gone down. That means for murder has gone down after the abolition of the death penalty. Homicide, the homicide rates in New York has also gone down. Why is there a correlation between abolition of death penalty and crime going down? If one takes an enlightened understanding of this, then one will also understand that we are talking about drug trafficking, not even murder. And so therefore, Singapore hasn't given proper studies whether there is actually a death penalty as a deterrence for drug trafficking.
So, but the thing is, Hong Kong is now part of China.
No, that's a separate issue altogether. Some Hong Kong, until today, let's look at the statistics and what it presents itself. And also, if you look at most South Korea, has been abolished death penalty.
Okay, what is your stance on, let's say, if it's murder then? Is that a death penalty?
Murder is a crime of passion. You know, on the spot, mostly...
Yeah, because some states in U.S. don't...
No, most of the states in U.S. have abolished death penalty.
Yeah.
Yeah, some states, like, you know...
They put them in prison the whole entire lifetime, and then it becomes another argument, whereas, man, these guys are going to waste the taxpayers' money.
If I've gone through many, many conferences, and I've attended in last 20 years, and it is the consensus in Asia, as well as in many parts of Asia, like South Korea, Japan, and all that. And at the same time, many parts of the world, as I said, 2/3 of the world have abolished death penalty. And it is only countries like China, Iran,
North Korea,
in that league is Singapore. You can see the enlightened nations holding on to the death penalty.
One mic stand. Dead.
Okay, then let me ask you. I mean, there are some camp that say, you know, if you do the crime, you got to do the time. Okay? If you do drugs, you know you're going to face a death penalty in Singapore. That's a law. And then you have another camp that says, you know, we shouldn't take another person's life. Like someone, this philosopher by the name of James Hetfield. Have you heard of him? No.
Yeah, no. Okay.
He has this holy book which is called Ride the Lightning. In chapter 2, verse 7 to 8, he mentioned that who made you God to say that I'll take your life from you? So there's two camps, you see. Where do you think Singapore will progress, let's say in 10, 15 years? Will they abolish this? Or are they going to please certain camps? You know, okay. Since this is a colonial law, we have to follow it. Or will they change the law?
You yourself have the answer. You just said, it is the colonial masters who passed this law, including caning.
Mm-hmm.
So they have abolished it in the 50s. In UK, I think in the 60s, they abolished it. Now, first of all, the reason being is that death penalty is disproportionately applied against the poor and the oppressed. In all my life, I've never seen one rich man being caught for drug trafficking. Murder, I'm not sure how, you know, but drug trafficking especially, they are all poor and oppressed and vulnerable people. Many of them come from broken home, and it is a structural system that has put them in place. So therefore, it is wrong to execute the poor, and you need to have a resolution on this issue, that if the poor are disproportionate in that scheme, then is it a structural issue? And yes, the answer is yes, because of poverty trap. Many of them, especially when they're young, and you know, all these kids have been recruited when even they're 14, 15, and then they 19, they come.
The mules,
yeah, mules. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. You said it very well. Mules. And that's the reason why, of course, credit to the Singapore government, when they changed this law, we were fighting and many years, and then Yong Wee Kong, the first case that this mule was allowed, that the guy was, I was like championing for him to not to be executed, and I did 4 years of campaigning along with all the activists who wonderfully did this work to save him, and then others escaped. So there was an enlightened path taken by the administration. Now the next right and enlightened path to continue that process will be to abolish death penalty, and that is only natural. That's only natural, because what if you have a miscarriage of justice? Like, for example, the recent case of Gobi, that the death penalty was set aside. The Court of Appeal said there was a miscarriage of justice. What if I hadn't taken up the case? Should it fall on my shoulder to take up his case? I acted for pro bono and I had my own challenges by the state and so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, I'm saying that, what if he was executed? I'm not a hero all the time or anything of that sort. I'm doing my part, whatever it is. I'm saying that, what if I have not taken up the case? We will have Singapore. It is Singapore would have got this miscarriage of justice. An innocent man would have been hanged. We as a state will be responsible for that. So which is why, when you have, this is a case to demonstrate that death penalty is wrong, because you cannot bring back that person back.
How many deaths have you seen, Ravi?
I've seen over the years at least I would say about 8 to 9.
How does that bring you, man? I mean, I would have been depressed as shit.
Now I'm handling 24.
Oh, man.
And 24 families. You know, not all of their families, but at least, you know, some of them. And of course, I try to see my clients. You know, it's quite exhausting to go to Changi Prison to see
them. How do you feel? Looking at the 8 or 9 deaths that you have seen, how do you go home?
You see,
man?
You know, first of all, like, I see Amara Tochi, the African footballer who was hanged in Singapore in 2007. And he was a footballer who came to Singapore, and then he was duped by this guy. So he was an African footballer, 14 years old. He was playing in Western Africa, and he was executed. I got his jerseys from Nigeria and campaigned, and I went to European Parliament to campaign to stop his execution. I came back, he was executed, and then 18 plus, he was in Singapore. So seeing all this, especially young people, and doesn't matter young or old, what I've seen is that all these are innocent in many levels. They're naive, they're kind. Our society, to kill them, that basically when we execute, state execute, it is the citizens who give the power to the state.
Yeah.
So yeah, I find it's unfortunate.
Like what I said, you go home every time this happens, and you know,
my problem is that, you know, you are right. I mean, my problem is like Vignesh Murthy's case, which was the first case where I haven't finished the story because it was too long. When I took that body from the, what do you call, the crematorium, right? You know that, we went to Sinming. Sinming, there's a place for embalming. Like, for 3 days, because the family was so afraid police might just take the body.
Correct.
So because we got it. So after that, during that, when I went to Sinming, we placed the body in a coffin, and then there was aircon room so they can sleep. They don't have to go to hotel, because 3 days just get the Malaysian relatives to come there to get a proper funeral, because many of them have to come from Malaysia, you know, because the Malaysian boy. I was sleeping below the coffin.
What?
Because that was below the only space coffin I had. The space is so small.
Okay.
You know, it was very painful. I was just too tired. I can't be bothered where I sleep, because I never slept for many days. But it was very painful for my friends and family who looked for me to come at night to see me like that, you know, below a coffin. There was no space. Then I was explaining the family so afraid that the police might just snatch. That's the fear that the police have set in this family's heart. And so I went, and the father couldn't even hold a pot. I think the father or mother must hold a pot.
That's a Hindu tradition.
Hindu tradition,
right?
You know, yeah. The clay pot.
Yeah.
And then they must break. So I was holding it for them. I was holding it on my head. And then I was going around the coffin, and then and so on and so forth. So along the way, many campaigns. Then I started the death penalty campaign, and people came, and other fellow Singaporeans joined the campaign, international community. Then we campaigned against the death penalty. But it was very tough, lah, because you know why? There's funeral, there's campaign, there's case. Always it comes to me at a hopeless stage where execution is set, and I have to fight this. So it was very tough.
And you met these people. All these people who've died. I mean, I'm not going to talk about the people who are still alive and 24 that you are championing for right now. Let's talk about the 8 and 9 because it's those are ongoing cases. How are they, man? Are they dejected? They've lost all hope? And then after that, here you come saying that I'm going to try this. I'm going to help you. I'm going to try as much as I can to help you go through this. And how do you interact with these people? You know? Because the general public would never know. Right?
No, interact means we must interact, because I come from a very compassionate family. My mom is a very compassionate lady who goes to extreme extent to help people, but not like that kind of championing rights and all that, you know. My mother, just one example about my late mother, of course I always feel that she's around because always I talk about her, right? She had a thali, you know, Indian.
Yeah, pendant.
That was the first pendant she ever bought. Until then, it was like neck was empty because we were poor. That is the one pendant and one bangle we can actually, when you know, we can go to pawn shop, right? That, you know, when she can go and when the hours of distress or need for any days. So just that next week, one lady came and asked, saying that she needs help, no food in the house and stuff like that. My mother never even bat an eyelid. And she's not so close to her, you know. And I was telling my sister and myself, were telling my mother, you know, I mean, like, you know, trying to tell her, you know, don't lie, you know, that kind of thing. But my mother, because we are frightened for ourselves, because
of
we
course,
won't
yeah,
have
been, yeah.
My mother didn't even say anything. And she just, gave away that pendant to her. And it never came back.
Without hesitation.
And she knew that it won't come back. We were saying this lady might not even give you mom and all that. It's in my book. It's in my... Everywhere I've written about this. I said my mother never questioned and she just smiled. She said that... Only thing she said, children, today we have something to eat that lady doesn't have. Tomorrow God will give us. Shut up.
The ending
shut up, blah. No, then my sister continued, shut up, blah. You know, then after, okay, I carry on, blah, you know. So, you see, my mom is, you know, mothers always care about children first.
Yeah, of course.
Here, my mother was caring about another person's family. To me, that electrified me in many ways, you know. That this extreme sacrifice this lady has shown, I don't think 1% I can be... you know, to follow the path. If I can, I'll be very, very happy and fulfilled. So, of course, it's the path that she has shown that I try to follow. But I will say that along the way, I've also been broken, you know, because it's very tough, you know. Because after the, you know, we all execute, but do we want to see the family? The politicians must go and watch the execution, how they suffer. The politicians must come to the funeral and answer to the families. Are you prepared to do all this, but you only can just execute? But at the end of the day, how many families are destroyed? Like Shanmugam Murugesu for marijuana, you know, just half a, I'm not sure, half a kg or somewhere thereabouts or 1 kg, I know. He was executed. He was a jet ski star in Singapore in 2005. His two sons went awry after execution. They were poor. Are you looking after the children? But so death penalty only open old wounds. It doesn't solve problem. It creates pain. And then, of course, we have to reconstruct the family. Many of these families are still in touch. Huh? Some of them have left Singapore. One lady, Shanmugam's mother, cursed this land and she went into India. She says that village will support HDB houses. It's so haunting. So relatives shun me. So this, you know, we displace people. But we have never solved the problem because drug trafficking is still on the increase. Over the years, and then comes down, it goes up, and stuff like that. So I'm saying that at the end of the day, this was ongoing, you know, this pain and trauma. I must be very honest. it was many a times that I took upon myself. It took a toll on my health. And, you know, I was admitted to hospital. I had my behaviors, a bit odd behaviors here and there, and so on and so forth. I took stock of the situation only the last few years. And, you know, I have managed to attain, I won't say perfect balance, some balance. So this 24 execution that's going to take place, which of course I'm trying my best in taking up applications as much as whatever areas of the law that I can exhaust, I will. And at the same time, I just surrender to the divine.
But that's every all. Time, let's say every time you fail in a case,
yes,
does that push you even further? Or does that make you even more dejected and, you know?
I never give up until the last day. That's it. That is what. You know what? Yong Wee Kong, this case that I took up, the activists were also championing, and people were saying, oh, you know, M. Ravi is full of shit, like, you know, giving all this false hope to the family and this and that. That boy is alive now. It's because hope is what we hold so strongly. And above all is the faith, either within yourself or whether within the universe. We find that reservoir of faith. Isn't the whole world is functioning because we believe that there'll be a tomorrow? If not,
I mean, it's better to have hope,
yes,
than no hope at all.
Yes, exactly.
And when you are in that situation, the only thing that you have is hope.
And any straw you will clutch.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, man.
And there is also this thing called a presidential pardon.
Yes.
How easy is for someone that's on death row to get a presidential pardon? How many times has it been passed down?
In fact, I argued in the court recently in Syed Suhail's case that the presidential pardon process has become futile because in the last 22 years, no single clemency has been granted, and more than 800 executions has taken place since 1965. In the last 22, almost or more than 400 executions have taken place. Not a single clemency has been granted.
Wait, hold on. Throughout the last 22 years, there's been 400 executions.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I didn't know that, man.
Not a single single pardon granted. Since President Nathan came to, you know, and then the rest of the presidents, since Nathan and the rest never gave. Last was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, was Ong Teng Chong, yes. Yeah. Since Singapore's independence in 1965, right after Ong Teng Chong's time, up to 1998, 6 pardons were granted. After that, 0 for death penalty. So therefore, my argument is that the death penalty, the pardon process is futile. It's almost useless, rendered useless. And therefore, it is unconstitutional.
And how many times can you apply for a presidential pardon?
I mean, you can just write a few times if you want to. But once the president decides, then that's it. So invariably, in fact, like many lawyers always tell me, useless lah. We just do our best, but it's useless. I mean, 22 years, not a single pardon. But why you call it a pardon process? The pardon process is there to mitigate the harshness of the death penalty. If you don't exercise that, then you effectively have no mercy. You don't even have a fountain of mercy in your heart, nor in the system that you yourself have called a pardon process. You see how harsh our system has become? Something's wrong, lah, seriously.
And you mentioned also that you are doing pro bono. Yeah. Is it just pro bono on those who are, serious cases or any case you take?
No, I'll be very honest with you. I also do a lot of commercial cases to support my, you know, work, earnings and, you know, well-being of the firm, financial well-being, and so on and so forth. You must not allow your staff to suffer. You have to also, you know, these are things that over the last few years I have like really learned. Because you know what? There was a situation when before I was suspended, there was a period of time, right? You know, a few years. During that period of time, I had a house in Bishan. It was possessed.
Possessed is a totally different story.
No, yeah, it's possessed because there is no concept of house in.
Okay,
let's go. Bishan was a cemetery, eh? Now you understand.
Really, yeah?
Because you know why? You know, everyone is so possessed with the concept of money.
Possessed?
See, when I speak about sensitive stuff, I speak Malay. Also, I don't know why.
Okay, so your house was self possessed.
Yeah, right? I was. No, I'm using possessed because I want to be very sure that you guys are alert.
Oh, really?
Hey, jangan goreng langka, mama goreng. Okay. So basically, yeah. So there was a writ of possession, and then my house was repossessed by the state. Under the writ of possession, it's not repossession, writ of possession. So basically, so from there, anyway, when I left my house, it's no big deal. For me, it's like, I know I can come up. I have been blessed with the, you know, whatever God has given me in terms of education and stuff like that. I had a yoga mat, which I love most, and my books. These are the ones who are going to really give me the knowledge here and beyond. Which I was very clear. But of course, after that, I got my financials right, financial planning right, and also how I should structure when I come back to legal practice. And I have firms in the region, like in Myanmar now, next I'm starting in Thailand, and I do regional work, corporate work as well. And then I do pro bono work mainly for death penalty. But here, sometimes I do charge when the families can afford. I do ask them whether you can afford or you can't afford. If you can't afford, let me know, and then see whether I can take it up or not. As much as possible, I do. But of course, other cases, I don't do a pro bono for every case. No. I only do for death penalty. Because the state has legal aid, why should I threaten the existence of legal aid?
Yeah, true. And I see that you, like what you say, the suspension thingy, and then after you were quite in quite a bad state. And now you seem like you're back, man. You're back at your best.
You're a brand new Ravi.
And probably that's because of your deep-rooted connection to your... believe in Hinduism and things like that. I've seen your Facebook. You fasted for 9 days or something like that. So, what's up with that, man?
Well, I say fast, but after that, you don't know what I'm doing at home. I buy me goreng and eat. Yeah. But once in a while, cheat also okay, lah, you know?
Yeah, like what Talib mentioned, I mean, you're a devout Hindu. I mean, you know your Hinduism history well also.
You've listened to that particular piece that you were speaking about just now.
You're very good in all this historical Hinduism, historical.
And your Tamil is pretty superb, huh?
So do you learn that or how do you go about that?
No, you see, I grew up with very good Tamil movies to start with.
Your favorite Tamil actor, man?
I just want to ask.
Sivaji.
Ganesan?
Yes, Sivaji Ganesan.
What's your favorite Tamil movie?
Tamil movie or all the classic movies?
You know what's my favorite?
You will not hear. You will not. These are all God pictures.
You know what's my favorite Tamil movie? All time. Nayagan.
Nayagan, I see.
Yep. You don't like, huh? I don't see that expression in your face.
No, you won't know. My 1950s, 60s, all that kind of movies.
You were not born in the 50s.
No, I was born in the... Yeah, but the thing is that I watched those movies. You mean to say that if I read about historical texts of Christ's time, I was born in that 2000 Egyptian time?
No, people grew up with movies, you see. People grew up with movies. I expect you to actually like be a little bit excited with Kamal Hassan movie.
Tak pandang lah siya.
Sivaji, you know, he overacts.
I like Sivaji the boss.
No, because the thing is that what you all miss is that because for me, Tamil being the oldest living classical language and has brought a rich tradition of universal philosophy, Sivaji was able to act out in the form of a king, poet, in many, many forms.
Oh, you mean you like the earlier Sivaji movies?
Yes,
not
yes.
When he's
no,
older.
No, even the latest one got the earlier story also. Yeah. Of course, got family story and stuff like that. The depth is there. But the beauty of the culture was, I was drawn towards ancient Tamil civilization through all these movies. So that was one. And then secondly, of course, for me, I just, I took to, because I was a top student in Tamil for many years since, you know, in my schools.
Your Tamil is pretty refined.
College.
I can see that your Tamil is pretty refined. Although I speak none of the language, but I have people speaking Tamil around me. And I see yours is pretty refined.
But actually, Tamil, if you really understand the Tamil history and the literature and the grammar, Tamil gave birth to Sanskrit, which gave birth to English and the European languages. It is I mean, okay, leave aside whether Sanskrit, Tamil. At the end of the day, Tamil and Sanskrit gave birth to five European languages and their grammar.
And the Malay language is also a borrowed language. You've got quite a bit of Tamil words in it.
I mean, whole Malaysia was, whole of Southeast Asia was Hindu until 14th century when Parameswara Devasha.
The Majapahit Empire.
No, the Majapahit Empire, one story, you know, Malabar Muslim from Kerala came and, you know, Indian Muslims attacked Parameswara in Malacca. And then converted him. Then only it became Islam. Right? Only 14th century. Anyway, he's sleeping in Fort Canning.
Oh, he is?
Yeah. Parameswara Devasha was known as Iskanda when he died. It's on the hill one.
I've been to Fort Canning twice in my entire life to watch Womet.
Bomo?
Womet lah. Bomo for what?
Oh.
Bomo is at your Habishan house.
Scary lah. <la, laughs> Hey, but I feel that you are Bomo. Hey, scary lah this place. Huh?
Really? Yeah?
Why? Yeah? Oxley Road.
It's not Oxley Road.
No lah. I said, you know, okay, I said that to the taxi driver, you know, because it is 67 Oxley, right? So Oxley Road, he was a panic. Why everybody panic at Oxley Road? Bang, so Singapore can process from Oxley Road lah.
Really, yeah?
Okay. I know you'll censor that, yeah.
Okay. One question for you just crossed my mind. Yes. I mean, most of our laws, I mean, we have to go back to this lah. Are passed down from our colonial masters. Do you think it's time we have our own laws instead of following these colonial masters' law? I mean, they themselves have.
We've abolished some of it, right?
Okay, very good question. And you also have answered that already.
Again, huh?
Just to give you an example, in 1953, in India, Mahatma Gandhi said, I mean, Mahatma passed away already. You know what's the thing with you?
You make this fiction
that you make
sound
us believe.
Factual.
No. Wait. Maybe I didn't put it clearly first. 1953, Indian Parliament abolished caning, and they cited Mahatma Gandhi saying that the first thing that When India gets an independence, they have to do, India must do, is abolish caning, which is barbaric and uncivilized.
What is your opinion on Mahatma Gandhi?
Mahatma Gandhi?
Yeah.
Mahatma Gandhi may have his other side of things.
Exactly, yeah. Which, I was going to get to that.
You know, listen, I have no time to kore orang pantang. Because when you kore people's pantang, it's
nanti bang.
Basically, you don't kore la pantat.
Okay, I just want your opinion.
I have no opinion about any individuals because I don't know them.
Okay.
I don't know Mahatma Gandhi. I never lived with him.
Okay.
If I know, then I can tell you. Okay. But from my deepest impressions of my heart and my universal vibrations,
yeah,
I think that he's a great soul because of what he did.
So, Talib, don't kore anyone's pantat tonight.
No. I feel that, you know, you must kore your own pantat and smell.
You do that sometimes,
No, but you don't kore. It's okay, man. Your own pantat, your own smell. Why you kore orang punya pantat and smell?
No, the thing is... Okay, wait. He haven't answered my question.
Okay, answer.
In Tamil, la solluvaanga neenga vandu unga kundiyai nondunga appadina. Mattavanga kundiyai neenga nondikittu irukkeenga. Naatham thaadikku appadina. Hey, you must cater to Tamil audience also, la.
Of course. Okay. You can answer in Tamil if you want to.
Yes. So, have you answered my question?
Yes. What's your question?
Oh, my God. About, you know, Singapore laws following the...
No, I already answered through Mahatma Gandhi that the law British colonial masters passed, for example, like caning that we are stuck, was abolished in 1953 in India, for example, which was the crown colony. And along with it, 377A, for example. You know, and all host of laws, you know, including the death penalty, doesn't make sense. It's barbaric. It was passed by the British. They themselves realized that, you know, they were actually barbaric, and they acknowledged the barbarism, and they think that it was right to civilize their society. But the countries, colonial countries like Singapore, they got stuck into these laws mindlessly. They are following dark ages.
No, actually, he made a good point. Crown colony.
Okay, we are seeing that on the topic of caning, because we had a guest here previously who is a drug addict, and he has been caned so many times. I mean, caning is supposed to be a deterrent. You get caned, you don't do anymore. But some people keep doing it, so it's not a deterrent in the end, right?
Caning has never been a deterrent. First of all, why was caning? Why was caning passed in Singapore? In fact, I challenged this in court, on account of Yong Wee Kong caning was administered, imposed by the court. In 1872, in Singapore's Legislative Assembly, that was when caning was introduced. And the reason why caning was introduced was that, in fact, I even mentioned this in the court, this parliamentary speech, that it was meant to deter the Chinese. And they said that the Chinese are the scums and, this is the word that was used, These are the riffraffs and scums of China. And they passed the caning. So the caning has...
Who said that?
Racist, the British... In Parliament, Mr. I can't remember his name.
Was this on record?
Record. Okay. It's all in court judgment. I have also in if you just Google this, what I've just said, M. Ravi said in court and blah blah blah, and the online citizen article will appear that the caning is racist in its origin. It was racist against the Chinese. They call the Chinese ruffians and scums and riffraffs of China. And that's the reason why they passed. They couldn't control the Chinese population because of the secret society and this and that. And they call this kind of terminology. So it was a racist in origin. And so that's the reason why I said that, amongst other reasons, why the caning should be struck down by the courts. The legislative object of a country cannot have this racist element. It cannot have a... It must have a rational objective, not a racist objective. And so that's the reason...
Do you want to be caned or Talib? Have you been spanked or caned by your parents?
Yes, I have.
You did? What do you do?
Many things, man, which is not worth mentioning.
Oh my God.
You call it your pantat, is it?
One of those, yes. And let the classmate smell.
Kore, you both from home.
Kore, 100 degree kan.
Any last words from you, man, Mr. Ravi?
Thank you very much for inviting me to this Spotify podcast. This is my first...
Wait, how do you feel? Yeah, this is your first time, right? First, how do you feel like being on...
No, I think it's fantastic as long as we don't get into trouble after this. There's nothing... everything has been
don't
moderated well. Nothing. Because all that we spoke, I think that, we are there.
We look for you if we
get into
trouble.
Yeah, no problem at all. I will look for you too.
Pro bono.
Yeah. Well, as I would like to go on record that I was under oppression and threat to be at this place. Record, it's on record, isn't it? Huh? If you want to delete it, then you're in trouble.
Okay,
I got my handphone. I never tell you what disclosure. Illegality cannot be,
Okay, but before we go, what advice do you have for up and coming lawyers or those who want to be in this profession like you?
Okay, first of all, then the question is that as to whether human rights lawyering, to be a human rights lawyer, is that the path that is one needs, how one can pursue this path. Of course, this path, human rights lawyer's path, is a path which the world needs lawyers to enter into because we are facing so many inequality and so on and so forth. And law profession is not just about coming there to make money. There's nothing wrong to be rich and to do good work and earn money in an honorable way. But as the heart of the legal profession is, it is a calling. And particularly a human rights lawyer, you must be called by the universe. You will be special. The path I took up is a special path for me. I know the sacrifice is immense, but it is satisfying. Because we leave a mark on earth. We do our part to correct injustice actively. And we use law to make changes in society. We use law to empower society, to motivate society. We, at the heart of constitutional law, for example, lies the fountain of compassion and equality and humanity. These are things that law needs. And this is where lawyers shouldn't shun this area. And Singapore I'll be very honest with you. I'm very impressed by law students and interns compared to even the senior lawyers I've met. They are more interested in coming to do internship with me and wanting to express. Of course, we also have to show a career path to them. That means they must be ensured that. See, for me, we make sacrifices. We go through the hardship. We find the way. They may not be in the same boat. They must have to still have to answer to their parents to also show the dollar back to show, so to speak, material success. So we must also create, I mean, that avenue for them as well to be successful career-wise as well. So unfortunately, many of them are not willing to pay. So, yeah, so we have to professionalize, so to speak, human rights, which is a bit difficult.
So you'll be seeing more M. Ravis, basically?
No. I won't say M. Ravis, basically, but I will say that I hope to see more like-minded individuals.
Mr. Ravi, it's a pleasure having you here, and a pleasure to have you here too.
It is my pleasure and my privilege.
Thank you very much, man. Have a good night. Cheers.
The honor is mine. Thank you.